Hey, everybody, it's Tom Rhodes. Today's guest, I'm very excited, is Mr. Brendan Burns, who is tearing up the British comedy scene, living in London, but the man is actually from Australia. And I met him many years ago, back when he was kind of a wild dog and a partier, and he's really kind of curbed his ways.
You're listening to Tom Rhodes Radio.
Karate kick, baby.
Rock and roll.
I went and saw Brendan's one-man show when he was in Los Angeles, and it blew me away. It's called, like, God and Metaphysics and Shit, or something like that. That's the name, that's the title that he has. And I was blown away by it. I thought it was a brilliant show, and he's warming up for this year's Edinburgh Festival. So I was supposed to talk to him when he was in Los Angeles, and I had a family issue, and we ended up talking on the Skype when he got back to London. So he's a lovable guy, and he's a wonderful man, and I think you're really going to enjoy it.
I got to tell you, man, I saw your show in Los Angeles, and it absolutely blew me away. I thought it was brilliant. And what is God, Love, and Metaphysics and Shit? Is that the name of it?
It's, you know, Love and God and Metaphysics and Shit.
Okay, I was close. And but I love the story, especially the love story, and I told my girlfriend about it, and, you know, we've hit some rough patches, and I think it really helped us. That I love that you kept talking about there's no substitute for being in love. But now I hear you talking to her in the background, and her name is Peen?
Bean. Her real name is Laura.
Okay, so although you weren't saying there's no substitute for being in love. You're saying there's no substitute for being.
There's no substitute for peeing.
For being.
No, it's nothing beats being. The bit is called Nothing Beats Being. But we're giving the ending away. People... because she hadn't seen it yet. Oh, I've got a funny story for you. So she hadn't seen the show yet, and I'm going to start doing it like on a bigger scale here. I'm doing Edinburgh. I'm got a national tour going, and there's talk of turning it into a special, but I realized she hasn't seen it yet. So she was seeing it for the first time the other night, but I told her maybe I should you know, take you somewhere and do it to you one-to-one rather than you having the pressure of other people or PRs and so on being around and you feeling forced to like this love letter comedy show that I've written for you. You know, I maybe it's better to do one-on-one. So anyway, when I took her out to propose to her, to ask her to marry me, we go on the boat and I pull the oars out. And I start my proposal, and she's looking at me like, this isn't funny at all, because she thought I was about to do the show. She's like, Brendan, you'll bum people out with this. What the fuck are you talking about?
Well, I thought it was a brilliant arc for a show. I loved everything about it. And then I also really loved...
Living it.
I also loved that you talked about... that you believe in God. And I think in Europe, that's quite a radical fucking statement. I say to people all the time, you know, most of the people you meet in Europe are atheists. And if you tell them you believe in God, you kind of feel like a jackass, you know?
Yeah. Well,
so I really like that also.
Well, it's not so much that. It's that I'm going after all branches of fundamentalist thinking. And it's not so much, you know... The idea that you're only given three choices of either you're a religious person, an agnostic, or an atheist. I'm like, it's the beginning of the universe. That's not enough. And it's not so much believe in God or anything. It's just, and this is just a logical premise as well. It's not like any kind of thing that I need to do. I just wouldn't be surprised if evolution's endgame seems to be sentience, surely it must have been an idea in the first place. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. And then I stretch that idea and hilarity ensues.
I thought it was beautiful because, you know, I mean, I was considering doing Edinburgh this year and I saw your show and fuck, I'm glad I'm going to wait because I loved the arc with your girlfriend. And yeah, you don't know if it's going to... if your relationship is going to work out at the beginning of the show, and you know, and then talking about God and metaphysics. I thought it was awesome, buddy.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy.
I think you're going to win that fucker again.
You can't win it again.
No?
No, the pressure's off me, baby.
Oh, okay.
No. That's the beauty of it. I go up, I'm out of the game.
Okay. I didn't know that. And then I want to talk to you about when you did win the thing, because one thing, when we were talking in Los Angeles, you told me that as a foreigner in England, you felt that there was like a glass ceiling. And I thought that was interesting that you would say that, because you already took their biggest fucking prize.
True.
True. Okay.
I think maybe there was an element of, we might have been in the US at the time. And
You're back there and you see things totally different.
Yeah. When you're in Hollywood, you're kind of like, you know, everywhere you go, it just seems like anything seems possible. You're hanging out with people that you think don't exist, you know, that exist on an entirely different plane. And, you know, I had just left management. It had been 8 months of trying to get things back together. And there was certainly a chip on my shoulder. And I admitted this on Mark Maron in his podcast, is the biggest chip, you know, was coming from a place of fear. And that was that I was frightened that people would think I was stupid just because I'm Australian.
Well, that's interesting, because I thought your show was anything but stupid.
Well, I'm done holding back intellectually, I guess. Like someone said, not everyone knows what sentience means. And I'm like, well, that's the cutoff point. I'm sorry. I'm not, you know, I'm not a particularly academic guy. And if I know sentience, then, you know, I'm dumb enough to get there. So, things are looking up.
Things are looking up. So, well, tell me about the first show then, when you won the thing, because I was really, I thought it was really amazing, because, you know, years ago when I would hear about you, you were like a guy that I wouldn't say fucked up somewhat, but I mean, you had kind
of, that's fair enough.
You had kind of a reputation for, I don't know, just being a wild man. I wouldn't say fucking anything up, just being a wild man, period. And then it seemed like you, I mean, you know, Bill Hicks had that. When I first heard about Bill Hicks, you just heard about his drinking and this guy who was a genius, but he burned his bridges because he just, whatever, got wasted all the time. And then the guy, he stopped drinking and he totally turned it around. Nobody ever.
This hysterical actually was, I told Rowdy Roddy Piper, I based the first 10 years of my career upon bad guy psychology. And I didn't realize this, that apparently Andy Kaufman was obsessed with wrestling as well. And it was that I was always interested in the bad guys as a kid. And so at comedy clubs, I started at 19 and I didn't really have many skills, nor did I. And it was something rather, there was a bit of a family tragedy and I moved to England. So I was very angry and young and confused, but I was also like, first comedian I ever saw was at age 9, was Flip Wilson. Then I grew up on like Sam Kinison, became obsessed with him. And so I was angry for real, but I didn't quite have the work ethic. I was pretty good at alcoholism, and I told, Rowdy Roddy Piper that I had bad guy psychology in that if I couldn't be the guy that everyone was talking about the next day through storming the roof off the gig, I wanted to be the one they were talking about nonetheless. So I would go down to play.
He took a shit on the piano.
Pretty much. I still wanted to be, I wanted any reaction. And so,
so what would you do to get that reaction?
Oh, if it wasn't going well, you know what? I don't remember, but I've been reminded a lot. whenever I hear these things and these stories and this reputation, I'm like, I wasn't that bad. And then I bump into people that like have flitted in and out of comedy.
Right.
and you bump into them in the street and they go, I remember I did a gig with you in Hemel Hempstead and you kept on setting fire to chairs and smashing your face with the microphone. And I'm like, that, did I? Really? Yeah, and you remember the time you took the crowd out to the street and you let a guy kick you in the nuts, see how quickly you could get back up. And
so how much trouble did you get in with clubs? Did you get banned from places?
I don't know. Banned, I think banned is a debatable word. Ed Byrne always used to say, you weren't banned, you just died and they won't book you.
Yeah, banned sounds a bit noble, but doesn't it?
It does. So, exactly. I think.
So, how did you turn it around? Was it the love of a good woman?
I just got to a place where I couldn't really do it that way anymore. You know, went into rehab, the usual rather cliched story, came out and became quite a productive guy, I guess.
So you cleaned up before you won that Edinburgh show?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no way the level of competition and stress and scrutiny and not only that, the fact of the matter is, when I won, I'd been gone for 10, you know, I'd been going there for 12 years or something already. And when you're a major contender, when you're a guy that they think they need to look at, everyone automatically goes to see you. That's why there's a dark horse sometimes sneaks in, because they only have to have 3 good gigs, because they'll send one person from the panel to check them out and they'll go, I love this guy. Everyone should go and check them out. So they will then get seen by the whole panel on another night. Whereas when the festival begins, they will go, right, we will all look at Burns because he always does good work and he always gets close. So the fact of the matter is a dark horse that no one was expecting, like, you know, a newcomer or whatever, they only have to have 2 good gigs. Whereas I had to knock it out of the park every single night. So if you're an Edinburgh contender, if you're going up there, someone that everyone's already considering, like this guy's always done with work, it is impossible for you to be caning it. You cannot do cocaine and get nominated for the Perrier or If.com or Edinburgh, whatever it's called now.
But there's a big misconception about Amsterdam. A lot of people think all drugs are legal in Amsterdam, and that is not the truth. Only marijuana, hash, and mushrooms. And they have stiffer penalties for harder drugs, like cocaine and heroin, than we do, and they have the lowest percentage of drug addicts in all of Europe. So anyway, I was in Amsterdam last summer, and I had a headache, and I was on my way to the drugstore to get some aspirin. And I remembered, hey, mushrooms are legal here. I could turn this headache into a magic carpet ride. Now, I want the children at home to see through the story and see that it's really a bad story that I'm telling. This is really a say no to drugs piece. So I got some mushrooms. And I'm tripping my balls off. It's a nice, hot, warm summer night, man. There's this beautiful park, Vondelpark. It's like the Central Park of Amsterdam. And I'm just running through this park, man. I'm feeling beautiful. I kicked off my shoes. I didn't care about the shoes. I just left them, and I'm running. I'm feeling beautiful. I look around. No one's in this park. I just start ripping off my clothes. I'm running naked through this park. I'm communicating with the one true God. Little plants were talking to me, telling me I was safe in God's perfectly balanced universe and that they'd watch my shoes. How come you never see that picture when you're in school? Whenever you're young and in school and they show you a picture of someone on drugs, he's always in an alley, mangled and screwed up, right? He's got one shoe on and leaves in his hair. They never show you the happy running naked.
I remember years ago doing the Melbourne Festival, and that's where I met a lot of British guys for the first time. I did it in 2000. It was one of the greatest months of my life. I mean, it was camaraderie. It felt like comedy summer camp. You know, there wasn't really this competition. And then that same year, I went to Edinburgh, and a lot of these guys that I saw were just relaxed and having the time of their life in Melbourne were nervous wrecks.
in Edinburgh and fucking drinking heavily and just like, you know, bummed out and worrying about numbers. And it seems like a month at the Edinburgh Festival.
Because Melbourne is someone else's money. There's your answer right there. It's like, what's going on here? This is the strangest thing. No one hands you a bill for $9,000 at the end.
Yeah.
Well, how did
you avoid that? That's always been my fear of, you always hear people have done the Edinburgh Festival and then they leave owing £3,000-£5,000. And I couldn't imagine working for a fucking month and owing people money.
I have never lost money there.
So what strategy did you use?
I was the guy that everyone was talking about.
That comes from shitting on the piano.
Yeah. I'm a shitty piano
so your
man.
Strategy, you thought you were fucking up, but you actually...
It was the perfect marketing. The only time that paid off was those 4 weeks in Edinburgh. Because also when I first went up there in 96, no one was really doing anything kind of outside what was considered good taste. No one was doing anything maybe viewed as politically incorrect. Not really. No young guy anyway. And admittedly, I was doing kind of party line politically incorrect, if I'm to be brutally honest. I think there's an element of that here. You know what I mean? It's like, you can make fun of these guys, you know, and that lasts for like 6 months and then everyone gets sick of that. And then someone invents a brand new underclass and everyone goes, the Polish are here. Let's go at them. And everyone does them until they get bored. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was interesting you told me that you thought that in America that comedians talked more about race. I think you mean in a constructive way, whereas over there it sounds like you're saying people just play on the stereotypes.
No, not even play on the stereotypes. I mean...
just bludgeoning.
I did a talk last night, actually, about offensiveness in comedy. First time I was in New York and everyone was talking about race and there was white comics doing race jokes. And I was like, what the fuck are these guys up to? What's going on? This is appalling. But then I looked around the room and I realized, wait a second, everyone's here. There's an Asian guy laughing. There's a black guy laughing. There's an Oriental person laughing. There's an Indian laughing. We can't say Oriental. Laura's just yelling in the background.
You told me in England, it's like, don't mention that the guy's black. He doesn't want to be reminded or something.
No, that's right. Don't mention. It's white people are worried. White people are worried of so worried of offending everyone because of their rather hateful 70s comedians who are no longer relevant to a whole new generation of people. There is a hint of patronization going on, and I discussed it that Britain is multicultural, but it's still a kind of middle class white art form, and we've stopped being relevant for different races because we're not willing to mention them. Exactly. If you go, can I ask you questions to a black guy? There'll be people going, no, he's black. Don't remind him. And I did a complete 180 after looking. Don't get me wrong. There was also some really lazy stuff going on of just saying to Mexicans, hey, you mow and you steal. And I'm like, what? What are you? Write a joke, dick. Be clever. You're just being rude. I don't buy into the whole, hey, this is comedy, so therefore I can say whatever I want. I think that's a little petulant.
Yeah, certainly, and I think everybody knows to, you know, somebody who's being blatantly racist would be called out, I think, by most intelligent audiences. But, like, you talk about the glass ceiling, though, you know, the perception that I've had, like, playing in England, I mean, they talk about Americans like we're fucking dogs, and it's really interesting, especially, I find that Canadian comedians do this a lot, and I got a lot of great Canadian comedian friends, and you'll be talking to them backstage, and they're like, yeah, buddy, and God, let's have a drink afterwards, and then they go on stage, and they just talk about how fucking stupid Americans are. So, I mean, it's almost like a hack joke in England. It's almost like in the American 80s, you know, American comedians would always do airline material. If you go to England, and a guy starts going on about Americans, it's almost, I think that's like really hack material over there. But the point I was going to make is the only people I've heard them talk about worse than Americans are Australians. And it's always, you know, and it's, oh, you're a barman, and these really stupid stereotypes of, like, the backpacking Australian. I mean, how much did that work against you, or did that work in your favor?
I think I've been adopted here. I think I've been adopted as theirs. I mean, not only that, they've heard me be rude about Australia enough. I always like to go after wherever I am. So I have no problem going after Britain while I'm in Britain. I have no problem of going after Australia while I'm in Australia. And I think that's born of they've told themselves that they can't make jokes about so many people that whenever someone pops their head above the parapet and it suddenly becomes in the ether, widely received, these are the people we can go after. Oh, that repression becomes all of a sudden loosened, doesn't it? They really do go nuts. And it is like shooting, you know, doing gags about it. An American comedian doing jokes at the expense of America in Britain is shooting fish in a barrel. You know, it really, really, you know, it just is. It's, and I do like it when some guys come over and go after England a bit. Because you know how they always say, well, we have this great sense of humor about ourselves, only on poor terms.
Yeah.
You know, you quite like it if we do jokes about, you know, your cynicism and your intellect. But if we go about your left-wing, covert, subtle use of language to avoid your racism, then, oh, I don't know about that. If we talk about you presuming that intellect has an accent or the colossal levels of classism going on here, oh, I don't know about that. And you're like, well, where's this great sense of humor about yourself? But you know what? To their credit, you can pretty much say anything to a white English crowd about a white English crowd. You'd have to really fuck. The only thing that you could do to fuck up, I think, and get booed off is to presume something they thought.
What do you mean? You know,
Doug Stanhope got booed off in Leeds because he was talking about the Queen and he's going, your Queen and your monarchy and rah, rah, rah. And everyone's like, what? This is Leeds Rock Festival. She's not even, I'm 18. The Queen isn't remotely relevant to me. And it's like, your Queen thinks this, that. But, you know, even Doug said he tanked it. He broached it wrong.
But the show you won in Edinburgh, that wasn't that, I didn't see it, but didn't that have a large thing to do with race? I mean, I heard that you had a shill that stood up and called you out or something.
What's a shill? Is that a plant?
A plant, yeah.
A shill? Is that Jewish?
No, that's an ancient, it could be. I mean, it's an ancient showbiz term. I mean, as soon as you explain sentient to me, I'll explain shill to you.
Some questions are just offensive to ask. You know, for instance, if you want to know if someone's Indian or Pakistani, it's okay to go, are you Indian or Pakistani? But it is always offensive to go, so which one are you? Sorry, what?
That's so racist.
Yeah.
Then why are you being racist?
No, like he just pointed out, I'm pointing out that racism exists, not being... You know, the jokes work a lot better if I don't have to explain them.
What have been racist? You've been offensive all night long and you've been directing everything towards me this evening.
You've really picked a weird moment to do this, lady.
You've been directing things at me. It's like you want my approval or something.
Well, of course I want your approval. I'm a fucking comic. That's psychology 101. There's cameras on me. Have you not fucking noticed?
What you're doing is you're picking on the brown girl. Make the brown girl...
Oh, fucking bullshit! I didn't even go there. Get fucked. You brought that up. Maverick, really, I'm being racist because if you were a fucking white chick, I would have cut you a new one. Bollocks!
I'm sorry you have been offensive, but dressing up as a Zulu with a bone for your nose.
Hang on, wait. Wait, I've got one for that. Hang on. You just threw me a lob. I'm ready for that. But she said, dressing up as a Zulu, that's racist. Wait. But what if you go into a fancy dress party as things beginning with Z? Oh, come on, Tom! Why are you here? Get the fuck out, bollocks. You're the fucking racist. Yeah, tell your story walking. Get fucked.
Oh, not did you start as well.
What? that even mean? Something about Nazis? Well, I reckon that might be an editing point.
So what was the big tension in the first show that...
That was the.
I mean, should I have done my homework and?
No.
I just thought I'd shoot my shit with a friend. I didn't want to do homework.
It was. I think they can see the whole thing on YouTube now. I don't know. Well, they're talking about releasing it in America, possibly. It was actually about the nature of all artistic outrage being selfish. And there was, I don't know if you saw it in America, but there was this thing in there was a big brother scandal, and everyone kind of went after these three girls for bullying Shilpa Shetty, who was Asian.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that we needed the conversation about race beyond the two-dimensional. Either people, whenever any kind of social issue comes up, and people pick a scapegoat over something, they always fall into one of two categories. And either that person is wrong and evil and vile, and I have never done anything resembling anything what they have done right now, and they must be condemned. Or, oh, well, this is just political correctness gone mad, and I'm going to use this as my excuse to carry on being a cunt. And I wanted to create a situation where everyone fell into one of those two categories. And so it was a very long, slow build-up. And there was a lot of – there was it was quite meticulous in its application, because there were so many things that inspired it. You know how sometimes when you come up with the idea for a show, your life just writes it for you, you know? And I – hello.
Is she showing your tits again?
No. I think she's sitting here holding the remote waiting to watch telly. Do you want me to go in there? Are you fucking kidding me?
I'm sorry, I got bored.
You got bored?
Hi, Bean.
Why didn't I stay in the bedroom? Right. Whole thing's off.
Whole thing is off.
The whole thing is off.
Yeah, my girlfriend, I told her all about the concept of the show, and I thought you were saying there's no substitute for being.
Oh, you're joking.
No, for being in love. That's the way I took it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, it really knocked my socks off. But now that I know the truth, that I'm less impressed.
Yeah, I know. It's being is her nickname. But that's like, oh, right.
No,
that's...
I'm kidding. I think it was a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah, it was, I've tweaked with it a bit more now to be a bit clearer as well. And there's one gag I've written that I think really kind of hammers it home that just came up. I haven't tried it yet. And that is, if I want to talk about intellect behind the universe and you bring up the Bible, whether you're negating it or agreeing with it, it still makes you the fucking moron, because it's not even relevant. I haven't even read it. I'm done being ashamed. I think that was also because a lot of, you know, everything in the show is my words. I'm not regurgitating text to try and look smarter than I am. It's just I'm exactly that stupid. But at the same time, if I have the kind of mind that spots patterns and follows signs, and that made me human nature. Evolution put it there.
What do you mean you're done being ashamed?
There's a lot of intellectual bullying in the UK, like you said. If you said anything along the lines of, you know, what I had to say, then everyone would then simply do the hog wild thing of, well, then you believe in Noah's Ark and you believe in Adam.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And my counter-argument is actually – my argument is against all fundamentalism, because not only that, if the only counter-argument someone can make is against fundamentalism, then their perceptions are fundamentalist. If you say to me there is no great big imaginary beardy man living in the clouds, yeah, that's right. but where the fuck did you get that from? And if that's, you know, I'm not, I talk about, if at a push, if I was to be defined, I'd be a pantheist. And that just means nature and God are one and the same.
Oh, yeah, you said that in the show, which I really liked. I mean, and that's, I mean, that was basically, you know, the movie Avatar, they took that from, but you know, when I was a teenager, I was really into the Native Americans, and they didn't have religion. Their religion was nature, and they, you know, they think that is God, and that's basically, they, you know, they took the whole concept from Native Americans, which I think is beautiful. And I have a psychiatrist friend that told me if more of his patients went into nature, he would have less patients. I mean, there's just something about, you know, the restorative nature and just understanding, you know, human existence by being in nature. I agree with you.
Yeah. And also I think if there's a very human need to pursue unconditional love, and yet the only single example, I don't want to give away the end of the show now, but the one of the only single times we're ever given it is the moment you're given life, because then after that, you are, it's all just free will. And if there seems to be some sort of moral code in the ether that's intangible, I just wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't an indifferent act of chaos and maths. That's all. I just wouldn't be surprised. And some people would, and that's fine. I'm done being ashamed, and I'm done with all the presumption and bigotry and intellectual bullying going on. Of, all right, yeah, you're right. Not that. That's preposterous. Yes. You know, everything you are saying is correct, but at the same time, you are doing very broad strokes. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, you're just talking about just people arguing their points.
And a lot of comics
have been
kind of coming up to me afterwards and going, you know what, it's really ballsy and I'm very glad you're doing it, and they're being very nice about it. And it's just a nice, I think it's a new direction for me as well, a bit older and a bit calmer.
I was blown away by it. I loved it. You know, your, you know, your God theories and the metaphysics, and then, like I said, the way you wove in and out, you know, your love story. So, you know, it's too bad you can't win the prize again, because you got that bitch, baby.
Well, I've got my friend Dave Eastgate coming over to set the whole thing to music.
Cool. But now, I don't want to keep you too much longer, buddy, but it was funny when I saw you in Los Angeles, you thought that I was mad at you.
No. I said, I want to make sure you're not still mad at me.
No, I was never mad at you.
You were never mad at me?
No. I mean, you know, maybe for... I mean, I was mad at the situation. It wasn't you.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I should explain that when, and it was interesting because it was August 2001, and I had just gone up to, Edinburgh to check it out, and, you know, I've always been interested in doing it.
Huh? I should chip in here. This was in my wild days.
Oh, okay, perfect. Perfect.
So you were still
partying and drinking.
I was a different guy.
And,
Richard Herring, introduced me. He's an English comic. And he gave me my favorite introduction I've ever had in my life. And he goes, coming up next, we've got Brendan Burns. Best thing about Brendan Burns, ladies and gentlemen, is you never know who you're going to get.
That's hysterical. So I had just gone up to check out the Edinburgh Festival. And what's his name? Louis Schaefer. You remember Louis Schaefer.
People love Louis Schaefer.
Louis Schaefer, a lot of people... didn't like that guy, and it was this all-American show, and people had gone to the Gilded Balloon specifically to fucking crucify him, and it was like lambs to the slaughter. There were all these American comedians going on, and everybody, you know, ate a bag of shit, and they're screaming, the audience, and then Rich Hall, my buddy, had laryngitis and asked me to do his set at the end to close it. And I'm such
a... Sure. You know what? He still pulls that trick to this day.
No way. That he has laryngitis?
Yeah. He never goes on... He always comes up with some reason why he can't go on last at Leighton Live.
Oh, my God. So he asked me to do it, and you know what?
I'm not well. I got to open.
That was it. Well, I mean, he asked me to do his spot, and, you know...
Not only that, Rich Hall had laryngitis. How could you tell?
Yeah.
I don't know. My voice is raspy. Really rich.
You know. So I'm arrogant enough in the back. I'm sitting there. I'm pounding one beer after another, getting my liquid courage, and I'm thinking they're going to fucking love me. And, you know, I actually thought, you know, fuck it. I'll turn this around. And one comedian after another, these American comedians. And it's interesting to point out that this was August 2001, a month later. All of these people were probably, oh, we love Americans. But fuck that. This was like a Hitler youth rally of people who hated Americans. It was so much venom and hostility in the room. And then when they introduced me, the sound man fucked me. He played God Bless America as I walked out. And this already rabid audience went apeshit. And I could still, I couldn't even get started because their screams were deafening. And I actually, I took a serene moment. I sat down Indian style and I lit a cigarette and I just sat there and soaked it all in. And I'll never forget these fucking, you know, guys standing and spittle coming out of their mouth going, go back to America and fuck America. And I'm not a flag waver. You know, that's the thing. Like, I was presented like this fucking Chevy truck Bush lover or some bullshit. And, I got one kind of laugh where I said, look, I'm an alcoholic. Just let me stay up here long enough to earn free drinks. And then they kind of shut up half the audience. And then I guess I didn't choose the right jokes. That was one of the single worst. That was like you hear about Vietnam veterans waking up in the middle of the night and they're like, they're still there. And they're like, oh, God, they're shell shocked. That's my
Schaefer said to some guy in the front row that night. Why did you suck my dick, sir? Because you know what you would be. If you were to suck my dick, you know what you would get? Your mother's AIDS.
Who said that?
Louis Schaefer.
Oh, my God.
And I pissed myself laughing. I was the only person in the room cracking up laughing. I think.
But it was a really hostile audience, man. Yeah. I've never seen so much venom directed at fucking comedians before.
Yeah, they do that. They used to do that in that room.
So I think that was one of the worst gigs I've ever done in my life. And I come off stage, and then you come up to me, and you went, hey, great set, or something like that.
No, I went, congratulations. Because I think, actually, that is one of the places that I got banned from. But they used the word, you are banned because of your behavior. Because there was, I think I was on a couple of nights earlier. That may have been the year that I was banned from there.
Hmm.
So I might have even said, hey, you know, we're brothers in arms, because I ran up to the back of the room and smashed a glass on someone's foot.
I thought it was hysterical. I always loved you to death. And then I don't see you for years. And the first thing I hear from you is, hey, I hope you're still not pissed off about that. I was like, what are you talking about?
No, we did have one late night drunken conversation about it. And I said I regretted it because I didn't know you well enough to make that joke. Because, yeah.
That's sweet of you. But no, I mean, I was so, oh my God, I was pissed. I tell you, I still wake up in cold sweat sometimes thinking about that fucking show. And then
really?
The funny thing is,
so many shows like that.
That's hysterical. You're like, really? That bothered you? I call that a Thursday.
Yeah. That's like, I can't believe it. You know what? I remember early on in my career, and it might have been one of the times when, like, slowly but surely, you know, seeds get planted. And I remember early on in my career, I was with two other comics, can't remember who, and they were talking about the time they got attacked on stage. It's like in my mid to early 20s, I think. And then I started reeling off all these incidents. Oh, yeah, there was like two weeks ago and I was in such and such and I'm reeling off about five examples just off the top of my head. And they went, how often do you get attacked? And I said, oh, I don't know, probably once a month.
Wow.
And they looked at me like, Brennan, that's not okay. And I was like, maybe I should try a different approach. This whole standing on top of tables and kicking, you know, pints over.
It's funny. Well, I know I told you that the connected caboose to the story was whatever it was 5 years ago or however many years later. I'm doing a gig in Atlanta. I'm sitting in my hotel room in my underwear, and I'm watching CNN. And Edinburgh is on fire, the old town. And they showed this diagram of what's burning in Edinburgh. And I knew the city, and I knew that the gilded balloon where this had happened was engulfed in flames. And I stood up in my underwear, and I applauded. You're like, oh, I get punched all the time. I'm like, I'll never forget that fucking place. I was the only one in Atlanta clapping that it, this place was burning down.
The beautiful thing, I think, like since 2006, I said as well that I could go up to Edinburgh, and ever since 2006, and that's when I got cleaned up, and I kind of also went a new direction in writing and performing, and because I realized a lot of people confuse not censoring themselves with just being awful. And I actually figured that the thing that I was most afraid of expressing on stage was actually that I was quite a nice person and that I was someone that could people could enjoy the company of. And so I started not censoring that as well and exposing that and being very vulnerable on stage and revealing a lot more about myself, because people used to always say, you know, nice guy off stage. You know, as long as it's not 1 a.m. And but I think I even remarked to Paul Byrne in 2006, I said, you know what's really nice about this is when people come up and say to me in Edinburgh, are you Brendan Burns? I don't have to worry whether there's about to be a fight or not. I can just, you know, say quite happily, yes, I am. And then we can take it from there. You know, there's no like finger pointing or throwing of. You know,
so did you consciously move away from jokes and just decide to speak from your heart, or that just came naturally from cleaning up?
Oh, I don't know. I've always written with a narrative arc. Ever since '96, I'm one of those freaks that comes up with an hour in like a 5 second flash, and then you know. There's the backbone, and the rest of like 6 months or whatever it might be is just slotting things onto the backbone of the show. And I've always worked that way. I'm not a very good circuit comic. That's why actually there are.
Yeah. How do you work in the London 20-minute set format?
I'm not the best at it. No.
Cause you see some guys in London, they get that perfect 20.
And just
do an A to Z and fucking boom, I'll make 80 grand a year doing this.
Yeah. And also they're brilliant at making it seem fresh every time they do it. I'm not capable of that. I would put a gun in my mouth. But I'm off the circuit these days anyway. I'm like a middling touring comic, I guess.
Oh, where you do theaters and things.
Yeah, but it's more like 300, 400 seaters.
Nice. How often do you get back to Australia?
I am now going back like once, twice a year. They take me out to Sydney. I love working Sydney. I'm not such a fan of Melbourne.
Yeah. So what do you do? The Comedy Store in Sydney?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite clubs in the world.
Isn't it just? Oh,
I love that place. And Sydney's one of my favorite cities in the world.
I think it's great. You know what I like about Sydney is that they know they're it. I'm not from Sydney either, by the way.
No, I know. You're from Perth. And I wanted to talk to you about that.
They know they're it, and so they don't really have any. Melbourne still has a bit of a tall poppy syndrome going on. So
what do you mean? Like they know they're the coolest thing in Australia?
Sydney knows they're the coolest thing in Australia by a long shot, and after them, there's a big drop off.
I think Sydney's one of the coolest cities in the world.
It is, isn't it? And so exactly, they've got nothing to prove. So they've got everything you.
Like I remember, I was talking to somebody from the club that worked at the Comedy Store, and they were from Queensland, and they were like, "Yeah, I got to." God, the hustle and bustle of Sydney. I'm moving back to Queensland. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Sydney's the only city I've been to where half the population wears flip-flops. It's a major metropolis. Everybody's just mellow and shuffling.
Yeah.
Wow, the hustle and bustle.
Where I'm from in Perth, I was, check this out. This was so quaint. Hadn't been home in years. And I was driving across the Swan River. And it's the main drag that goes past the central business district, right, and to the airport. So it's the road that goes from the suburbs to the airport, along the river line, in front of the central business district where all the sky rises are, and two lane traffic stopped to a halt to let some ducks and their chicks cross over.
Downtown Perth.
And it was like, there was like, you know, a queue. And no one complained. Everyone was like, "Oh, look at the ducks!"
Wow. Well, I need a favor from you, buddy. I would love to go to Perth once in my life, just to go to Bon Scott's grave. I think the way Muslims go to Mecca every year or once in their lifetime is a pilgrimage. My pilgrimage would be to Perth to see Bon Scott's grave. But if that never happens for me, can you get me a Ben Cousins jersey?
Who is Ben Cousins again?
Ben Cousins played for the West Coast Eagles. They won the championship.
And he slept around.
The last time I was in Australia, like 2 or 3 years ago, the cops busted him at like 6 a.m. They had him coming out of this club. I mean, he left this club, and he's totally on ecstasy or meth or something. But the guy's beautiful, and he's got this ripped body, and the cops have his car surrounded, and it was on live television in Australia, and they kept repeating it on the news. Okay, the cops have your car surrounded, right? I think his best friend had just died from a meth overdose like a couple weeks before.
Is huge in Perth.
So they're closing in on the guy. So the cops have you surrounded. What do you do? He takes off his shirt. And he gets out of the car, and he's got Such Is Life tattooed on his stomach, the way Tupac Shakur had Thug Life tattooed on his stomach. And I never knew that was Ned Kelly's last words were Such Is Life. But I haven't seen a saunter like that since Jim Morrison. The cops have him surrounded, and Ben Cousins. Favorite dead people. This is an odd little thing I started doing years ago in my travels, I like to go to graves of people I admire. And so I've gone to graves all over the world. This is the end, beautiful friend. I think it started with going to Jim Morrison's grave in Paris, and then also in that cemetery, Père Lachaise in Paris, is Oscar Wilde is buried there, and people have put lipstick kiss prints all over it, and it's on my website. And who else? Victor Hugo is in that cemetery. And then I went to Hendrix's cemetery in Renton, outside of Seattle, and Bukowski's grave in San Pedro, outside of Los Angeles. It's just this weird little hobby I've got. I've been to Sam Kinison's grave, Mickey Mantle, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Voltaire. No, but as much as I like going to graves, I think it would be cool to have like a jacuzzi on top of your grave and like maybe a beer dispenser machine. Who knows? I saw this thing. I was driving down to Sarasota, and they had a sea coral burials. You can pay money and have your ashes put into a little tube, put into sea coral. Is that legal? In New Orleans, they have those spooky graves where they're above ground, and there's been a few times, like after Hurricane Katrina, and then some other time they had a flood where, like, the caskets flowed out into the street and strange things like that. Yeah, it's very marshy in New Orleans. That'd be a bad place to be buried. I would like a Viking funeral where they just set the boat on fire. And all